I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Rob started the company in 2005 while he was 25 years old, and Etsy has more than 1 million artisans who sell their items on the site. Welcome.
Thank you.
So prior to starting Etsy, you were living in Brooklyn. You were a woodworker and furniture designer. What kind of furniture and woodworking did you do?
I was doing a lot of different stuff. I had a line of what I called 2x furniture, where I was using 2x4s and using some intricate joinery and making these rustic-looking tables. And prior to that, had taken this long path of just doing everything from demolition to sheetrocking, so learning my materials.
How did you first get introduced to woodworking and working with your hands?
Through my dad, who he started his own company in architectural specifications when I was growing up, and he was the person who picked what materials things were made out of, so all these companies would always send him free materials to try and encourage him to specify them in the buildings. And so I just grew up with tons of free samples of tile, and I remember a piece of bulletproof glass with a bullet shot in it, and was making things out of it. And then combine that with the kind of natural curiosity and desire for self-reliance, and you just basically start making things.
You mentioned self-reliance. Was that the culture of your family growing up, where that you would make a lot of the things that you would use?
I think that actually grew out of this idea of laissez-faire parenting that leads to self-reliance, because my parents just kind of let me go. And lacking that direction, you realize you can create that direction for yourself.
Did your parents consciously want you to just have the freedom to do what you wanted, or they were distracted by other things that might have caused that laissez-faire approach?
I would love to ask my parents that question. My dad was at work a lot, and I didn't see him all that much. I don't know. A lot of the schooling that I went to was just standard public schooling, and I really couldn't fit into that. And so I was challenged at a really young age with either getting kicked out of class all the time or trying to make something hold my attention. And that type of process led me to see the world as I wanted to see it. So I would try and change it to fit me because I knew I couldn't fit into it. And that led, you know, when I was older, to seeing psychiatrists and getting prescribed, you know, Adderall and things like that, which never interested me.
What's an example of things that you tried to change to fit or be more aligned with yourself?
Sitting in a desk with a textbook in front of you was something that was very difficult for me, so I would ask the teacher if I could, you know, sit on the radiator. I remember this from like 6th, 7th grade, going back even earlier.
What did they say?
Some of them would say yes.
So what are other examples? What else?
Not being able to keep my mouth shut, getting kicked out of class. I remember being really young, and I'd gotten kicked out of class, and I was standing in the hallway, and the principal walked by. And this is in elementary school, and I still remember this so clearly. And he said, "What are you doing out in the hallway?" And I really quickly said, "We're playing a game, and I'm supposed to be standing out here while they do something." And then I go back in, and he just kind of said, "Okay," and he kept walking.
What part of all of this existing outside the mold was just kind of stimulating for you, and you kind of got a rise out of being a troublemaker?
I hope I wasn't trying to be a troublemaker. I hope it was just me being me. One of the things that's really difficult for me is I notice far too many things. Like, I see a lot, so it's always like I have this type of sensory overload and I have to choose what to focus on. And I've always thought attention deficit disorder is the exact opposite. It's more like attention excess disorder, where you're trying to pay attention to too many different things and then you can't focus.
You mentioned that your father worked in architecture. What about your mom?
My mom has been a teacher since I was really young, and more specifically teaching kids with behavioral disorders.
So how did she feel when she thought her kid had just that?
It was interesting. She kind of passed me off at one point to, you know, to the professionals to see, okay, well, you know, I remember being 16 in this pivotal moment of discovering photography and probably smoking pot for the first time, just really opening up these different paths to creativity for me. And, you know, at that point, I was going into the city and Boston all night and taking pictures at night. I was doing a lot of night photography, and I would come home and I would pass out. You know, the tea in Boston, the last tea is, you know, probably around midnight.
The tea being the subway.
Yeah. So I would go in on the last tea, and I would walk around, and then I would come back on the earliest one, come home, sleep for an hour, and go to school. And I would go to school, and sometimes just cut all my classes and go sleep in the photography room. And then I would come home from school, fall back asleep, and get ready for another night out. And all my mom saw of that part was me sleeping all the time. And so she said, well, you must be depressed.
So she said, you must be depressed. Did you feel depressed? Were you like, oh, she must be right, she's my mom? Or was she? Or did you think, oh, she just doesn't know that I've been out?
When you're 16, I think you, by default, think everything your parents say is wrong anyways. So initial reaction wasn't to say she was right.
Sitting here with you, you seem a little bit soft-spoken and demure and well-behaved. It's hard to believe that you were kind of a miscreant or a maverick growing up. Have you always had this same disposition?
No. This has been a big change. And I remember, you know, nicknames from being a kid all had to do with me not being able to shut up or sit still. And there's a lot of patience that you learn in starting a business and working with other people. And it's also just adapting yourself to what's around. And I'll point out, this is a pretty quiet and demure place. Mm. So I feel that way. But yeah, when the company was just me and two engineers working out of my apartment, there was more screaming with those three people than there was in the company of 200 cumulatively across that entire company.
Your parents divorced when you were in high school, and you went to high school outside of Boston in Newton for 2 minutes, and then you dropped out.
I made it up to the beginning of my junior year and then just discovered photography and stopped going to classes. And also got a job. My mom dropped me off in town and said, don't come home until you have a job. And I was a cashier at Marshall's. It was my very first job during the Christmas season. I think I was the only person under 60 working there. And that was a great experience, because I think a lot of how you learn what interests you is by learning what doesn't interest you. And getting that window opened really early on was helpful.
Did you feel unconditional love from your family while you were going through all this hardship?
No, there were times in there where, I mean, my parents' divorce was really tough for me. And there was a time where I wasn't really speaking with my mom. And I left home and went and lived with my uncle in South Boston. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was just me discovering who I was. And I think I was so intent on that exploration that I naturally cut my ties, you know, my really close ties with my parents there. Mm-hmm. And it's been a fun journey where you realize how you can get deep into something that you really care about and that can take you away from these other relationships that are really important. I saw my dad do this in my parents' marriage, where, you know, he focused on work to the point where, you know, my mom didn't feel loved. And I've definitely caught myself doing that with my work. You know, the girlfriend that I had when I started Etsy, you know, left me about probably 8 months into starting Etsy. And there's this balance, and you really have to decide what you care about and what matters most at that moment.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. So here you are in 2005, 25 years old, living in Brooklyn, trying to make a life being a woodworker, furniture designer. How did you come up with the idea for Etsy in that moment?
I graduated from college, my fifth college, and had that BA and kind of held it up and said, all right, well, time to go get a job. And seeing what doors that degree opened for me was a huge disappointment, where I saw people who were a year older than me who'd spent all of this time studying literature, and the jobs that they were getting were a notch above or alphabetizing filing cabinets at a publishing firm. And I wanted to do something that didn't waste this incredible education that I felt like I'd received and created for myself. And knew at that point that if I just went to work for some other big company, I wasn't going to be able to realize that. So started my own company with woodworking and said, okay, well, I'm going to make furniture. And I was making these couture computer cases. I was making wooden computer cases and looked for the best way to sell those, and looked on in the offline world. And there's consignment, there's wholesaling, and neither of those were really my cup of tea. I looked at the online world, and neither of those really worked out. And so that was on the back burner. And then the magical moment happened when I started working with Jean Rayla, who was the creator of Get Crafty. And she's an amazing person. I met her through a professor at NYU that I knew. I was starting a web development company as way to learn in one sense, where I didn't know anything about making websites, but I felt like there was something magical about that medium. And she asked me to help her rebuild Get Crafty. And that was my introduction to designing websites and then also building something that's helping communities organize and helping people communicate. And the community there was definitely crafters and a lot of them women who were doing their crafting as a hobby and looking to sell some of the stuff. And I was looking to sell my own furniture, and so that idea percolated, and I talked with Jean about adding a marketplace to Get Crafty, and she said, and I probably agree with her, that it would probably be better to start the marketplace separate instead of doing it inside of Get Crafty, because Get Crafty was really just a, you know, community of people talking. So one thing led to another, and the idea of creating the marketplace as a marketplace took birth.
What, by the way, was the name of your furniture company?
The same as the name of the marketplace. I actually still have my very first business cards where it says Etsy and there's a picture of this plywood table that I was designing on the card. I just found that when I was packing stuff up.
You came up with the name Etsy. It was inspired by a Fellini film called 8 and a Half. What's that story?
There's a scene where Guido's having a flashback to his childhood and there's a painting on the wall, and if you say this magic phrase, Asa Nisi Masa, the painting comes alive and looks at where this hidden treasure is. And so for me, it's just that idea of a magical nonsense word that when you utter it will reveal hidden treasures.
At what point did Etsy go from a vehicle for selling your furniture to your sole endeavor? Like, wow, I'm going to focus all my time on this and forget the furniture thing.
When I initially started Etsy, my thinking was I'll build the marketplace where I'd like to sell what I'm making, and then I'll get right back to making these things, and I just need the right venue to sell them. And another component to that was I was trying to set up my own e-commerce shop to sell what I was making on my own, and it was this lonely little website on the vast internet, and I'd seen the power of community working with Get Crafty, and there was another site called Craftster. And I wanted that community to bolster the marketplace. And, you know, I looked into things like CSA, community-supported agriculture, where you have a model of commerce that if it's just the kind of straight-up capitalism where its values are based on price and convenience, then in some cases it actually just won't work. There's a great documentary I just watched called The Real Dirt on Farmer John, and he was trying to make his farm successful. And the farm wasn't successful until he adopted that communities supported agriculture model. So that was in the back of my head as well, where that the community component to it would be central to making the marketplace work.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, founder of Etsy. We'll hear more from Rob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Rob started the company in 2005 while he was 25 years old, and Etsy has more than 1 million artisans who sell their items on the site. Once you launched Etsy with two of your friends from NYU, did people come immediately? Talk to me about those early days.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember just launching the website, and one of the beauties of the web is you just push a button and it's globally accessible, so you're just kind of sitting back wondering who's going to discover it. And we'd spent an arduous 3 months building it, so we launched it and then just went out to dinner, came home, and I think fell asleep. And then in the morning woke up and saw that a couple people had registered, but no one had put any items up. And then someone opened a shop, someone lists a couple items, a couple days go by, someone bought one of the first items. And that is one of the most amazing feelings, to see something go from nothing to all of a sudden you're connecting people, you're helping people sell things.
What were some of those things that people sold in the, you know, first day, 2, 3, 4 week?
I remember buying a crocheted cat toy with catnip in it, and that was one of the very first items listed. And crochet and knitting have always played a kind of central role to the identity of Etsy. I used to tell people that the name was an acronym for everything takes some yarn.
And you had 3 cats at the time.
Yeah, I was working at an animal shelter, and just those cats that no one else wants. I'm a sucker for taking those home.
Did you purposely buy a lot of the items from these craftsmen in the early days just to give them kind of this positive feedback that, oh, yes, this site works?
I wish I could have done that. I was broke. I was working for my landlord to, you know, kind of not have to pay rent, and was buying what I liked and what I could afford at the time.
Did you list your own furniture on the site?
Yeah, I listed one of my computers and...
Wait, you're one of your computers or computer cases?
I mean, it was a full functioning computer. Like, I put the guts in it. I wasn't, you know, soldering any of them, but I was assembling the components. So you'd push a button and it would turn on and it was a working computer.
So you put one of your computers on Etsy and what happened?
I charged what I put into it, basically not making any money, but it still mean the thing costs around $1,000. And so, especially in the beginning, it was mainly the lower price items that were selling. So I put it up and it worked great for press because I guess it was a noteworthy design. And so that got picked up. And a lot of that early momentum comes from people writing about what you're doing. And that's been one piece of advice that I've always given to Etsy sellers asking how to be successful is make things worth sharing and worth talking about.
You mentioned you had friends who helped you launch the site and you'd have screaming arguments with these colleagues from NYU.
I would call them loving arguments. And that was Chris McGuire and Chaim Shopik. And still have a lot of love for those guys. That was just us, in some ways, not even knowing what we were getting into. But I remember one time sitting down on the couch with them and kind of putting my arms on their shoulders and saying, what we're about to do is incredibly difficult, but the only reason we have this opportunity to do it is because of how difficult it is. If it was easy, it would have been done, or other people would be doing it better than us right now. Mm-hmm. And going into that together, that type of camaraderie, I think that you have both sides of things going well and things not going well. It's kind of like I've heard some people say when a couple stops arguing, it means the love's gone out of the relationship, where there's always both sides of that.
So people trickled in initially. When did you start getting traction where you thought, wow, you know what, I have something here? Was it a specific person who bought something, or was it just the volume of people who bought something or sold things?
So to me, I've always measured success for Etsy on making other people successful. So early on, looking at how we were measuring that, it was more what people were talking about in the forums, which became the central place to communicate.
What's an example of that?
There are stories of a woman whose kid was really sick, and she was spending a lot of time in the hospital, and she'd been getting really depressed, and she started selling what she'd been knitting, and that gave her this new motivation to knit more. Turning her hobby into a business coincided with, you know, her son being in the hospital and getting better. And you learn about all of these things. And having visibility into that, to me, is this huge motivator. And that's the beauty of the web, is all of these serendipitous connections that can happen.
Your grandfather helped you in the early days. Your grandfather had worked at IBM. What kind of help did he provide?
He was a good sounding board. A lot of his advice I didn't take, for doing the basics of the business side. And I've never been strong in finance, and I've never been strong, you know, even writing the traditional business plan that he was looking for. And the earliest fundraising that I did with Etsy, which to me is the most meaningful, was going to people who I'd built things for and saying, here's something that I'm building, would you like to support it? And those were people who, above everything else, were investing in me. They didn't need a business plan. And, you know, fast forward a couple of years and going out and raising venture capital, completely different game. And, you know, my grandfather was much more used to things at larger companies. And I remember the first investment we got, he said, why would anybody give you money? And then he met with that investor, with Spencer, who's a great guy. And the first thing he said to Spencer was, how would you feel if Rob lost all of your money? And Spencer said, it would sting, but okay. And for my grandfather, that was the prerequisite for letting him invest.
So who was Spencer, and why did he give you money?
Spencer,
and how much did he give you?
Etsy's first two investors were Spencer Ain and Sean Meenan, and then Spencer's brother Judson also invested. I met Spencer because I remodeled the bottom floor of his duplex and built him a bar.
And
he lives above Tower Records on Broadway. And I met Sean because he was opening up Habana Outpost across the street from my apartment where I started Etsy in Brooklyn. And he needed some computers and he wanted to give the whole neighborhood free Wi-Fi. So I remember hanging over the side of his building, installing an outdoor wireless antenna. Those are the types of relationships where once you've formed that, you know, for Spencer, it was, okay, well, you built this bar and I've worked with you, and for Sean, it's you hung over the side of a building for me. And they both ended up investing $50,000 early on.
At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to need more capital than just, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 for this?
I wish we had that type of choice. You know, thinking back, there's a lot I'd like to have done differently about those early days. We hit these walls where we had to scale the site for growth, and we had to go buy hardware, and things like Amazon Web Services didn't exist back then. So I remember the engineer I was working with just saying, we need 20 grand in 2 days or the site's not going to come back online. Those were the walls that we hit where it was really capital intensive and had to go out and raise more money.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. Etsy cuts out the middleman by connecting buyers directly with artisans who sell items ranging from clocks to knitwear to guitars. Rob started Etsy in 2005 when he was 25 years old. In addition to the early angel investors, who were some of your allies in the early days?
Soon after I launched Etsy, I wrote a fan letter to the founders of Flickr, Katarina and Stuart, who were heroes to me, just asking for their advice. Flickr, the photo sharing website currently owned by Yahoo, and they invited me out to San Francisco and made the rounds out there. They were super helpful. This was back in 2005, so before there were really any web startups in New York City.
Why were you so entranced by Flickr?
The craftsmanship of what they'd built and the sense of community around it. And that was one of the first websites from a design perspective to just cut away all of the cruft and just show the content of the page. And I was spending a lot of time designing Etsy, and that was a big influence on me.
What did you ask for in the letter, if anything?
I wrote them a letter the way a kid throws a penny off a building, you know, not really expecting any kind of reply. And I think it took a couple tries, but Stuart got back to me first.
How did they help you?
First, it was just, you know, there was this world that I knew nothing about. You know, I'm someone who just was meandering my own path out east and then, you know, went to visit them in San Francisco and went down to the valley. And Katarina up front was helpful just kind of saying, here's what I think is good about this world and here's what I think is not so good about this world, and making a lot of really good introductions. And, you know, there was a brief period of time where I was thinking of moving the company out there, but I'm an East Coaster at heart. I need winter and seasons, and so knew that I was going to keep the company in Brooklyn.
At some point, they introduced you to Fred Wilson, who runs Union Square Ventures, a leading venture firm in New York City. How did that encounter go? You said that you were starving for capital, so was venture capital the road you wanted to take?
No, initially we were just looking to do a small angel round, and one way that I've grown the company since the beginning has always been basically take what you need and no more, and spend what you have and no more. Again, this is my grandfather's good influence on me. So, you know, we were going to raise, I don't even remember the amounts, you know, probably $250,000, and we were wrapping that up, and Katarina said, we'll just go meet with Fred, and I had a dinner with him. And for me, and maybe this makes me old school, I don't know, but a handshake will mean more than a contract, and, you know, looking someone in the eyes and connecting with them means more than a term sheet. And found both of those things with Fred, where had a good reputation and definitely understood from a product perspective what we were trying to build. A lot of people at that time, I remember, like, when eBay was starting, people looked at Pierre and said, people won't buy things over the internet. And with Etsy, a lot of people thought, oh, crafty, handmade things, tiny market, that kind of thing. And for me, this was building something that was going to change the way the world's economy worked. Mm-hmm. And he definitely got that. So there was that connection.
When you launched the company, you were the founder and CEO. Since then, there have been some other CEOs that have come and gone, from Maria Thomas, who incidentally was a former employee at NPR, and most recently, Chad Dickerson, who was the CTO of the company, the chief technology officer. And in between Maria and Chad, you were again the CEO. That implies a certain level of turbulence. What's the story there?
So I was the CEO for the first 4 years and knew that there was this swath of business acumen that I didn't have, and in some ways wasn't passionate about. You know, I knew what I was passionate about, which was much more on the product side and the customer support side. So You know, I was always honestly trying to do what was best for the company. And so that first shift was me stepping aside, saying, I think this is what's best for Etsy. So I said, I'm going to focus on the product stuff and you get to run the business, and tried that out for a while. And that didn't end up working out. And then when I came back, same thing. I said, okay, well, here's what my original vision was. Here's what I think is happening now. And I want to return to that.
How do you feel now not running the company?
It was amazingly painful to go through. I mean, the emotions. It's not quite as bad as having your heart broken by someone you love, but it's also losing your life's work, and for me, losing 6 years of work in one fell swoop. And I lost all of those connections to, you know, the company was 200 people, and those are people I really, really loved collaborating with, and I lost all of that in an instant. And I think in some ways that's just like being in love and having your heart broken. You know, sure, you put your heart back together, but you remember that it was broken. And so to me, understand what it means to be an entrepreneur and be a CEO by having it whisked away from you, you know, by getting booted out of your own company. It's been tough, and I've been rebuilding and thinking about what I want. I've gotten married, expecting a kid, and it feels okay now, but there's definitely still these flashpoints where you think back to the things you wanted to do, you think back to the people that you miss, and it's really hard.
Did you understand why the investors no longer wanted you to be CEO? Or was it going through, like, anger, denial, you know, those...
Denial, anger. Yeah, that's very accurate, and you traverse them. I mean, they were doing what they thought was best for the company.
Right.
You know, Fred Wilson wrote a blog post about my lack of management skills, and my biggest regret about all of it was I wasn't given the chance to take their feedback and learn from it. And I'm actually the type of person that really likes criticism. You know, it's going back to art school where you have crits and people come in and they really challenge you about what you're doing. And to me, that's how I get better. Mm-hmm. And never really got that level of criticism from the board so that I could get better. And when I did get the criticism, it was, here's our criticism of you, there's the door. And that was the hardest part for me.
Our producer just told us that it's the Kubler-Ross model of grieving. So denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
I skipped the denial part. And in some ways, I skipped the anger part. And then that came later. I may have to revise this model. For me, it was I felt sorry. And in a way, I wanted to apologize to Fred for what I felt like was letting him down. This was someone I'd been working with for years at that point, and on the one hand, have earned him probably around a 50 times return on his investment. But on the other hand, felt like, you know, when you're taking people's money, you're making a pact. And that understanding that I had with the earliest Etsy investors, with Sean Meenan and Spencer and Judson Ain, was that you did right by me and I'm going to do right by you. And we definitely had disagreements along the way. I think Sean at one point threatened to punch me in the face for something I was doing that he thought was really wrong. But throughout those relationships was always given the chance to show that I could learn. And so it went from that feeling of being sorry to that feeling of being treated unfairly, and this realization that, hey, you know, I generally live my life by treating other people the way that I would want to be treated, and this is a way that I wouldn't treat someone else. And so that led to confusion. And then those give way to anger after that. I remember going home and going to the beach just to, you know, try and clear my head, and just sobbing. And that's still there. You know, you don't ever get over that.
What have you bought on Etsy most recently?
A rocking chair and, I mean, gifts for other people. But also, to be honest, haven't done that much shopping on it since I got the boot, just because it's like going back to your old neighborhood where you got beat up.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing now?
So also, I'm having a kid, and a big challenge for me is build the educational experience that you would want your own children to have. And so I'm starting parachutes.org up in Hudson, New York, and I'm going to be starting a school.
What kind of school?
Unlike any other school that has ever existed, it'll be a one part trade school where, you know, how do you understand what your avocation is? And then one part vocational training where here's how to make a living doing what you love.
What ages?
My preference now is under 7 and over 70, so to have this really interesting juxtaposition of younger people and older people.
What was the impetus for moving to the Catskills from Brooklyn, even though you still have a place in Brooklyn?
I have family from up there, and also thinking about starting a family of my own. Would much rather do that in a place where you can have a better connection to the land and your food and the local community there.
By the way, what does your home look like?
I just found this book in a bookstore titled Handmade Modern, and I was like, wow, that's my aesthetic. So I like the cleaner lines of modernism, but I can't stand the blankness of the materials that they use. And so I like everything from, you know, hand-hewn wood beams to using lots of reclaimed materials and being able to see the imprints of previous generations on those materials that you're using. And so they have, you know, I have flooring that used to be beams in a factory in Pennsylvania, and you know, tabletops that have been made from bridges, and these things have previous lives, and that you're working to restore some of their utility after they've moved from one thing to another.
Your wife's name is Layla. How did you meet her, and what does she do?
She designs and makes clothing, and for a lot of musicians, she was working in the same building that Etsy was in, Etsy's first office building. I was learning how to sing and play guitar, and I'd spent about 3 years getting over all of the bashfulness around what it takes to perform for other people. And there was this really cool back stairway in the building that was all concrete, so lots of reverb. And I invited her up one night and got up the gusto to sing to her, and I was like, well, this is either going to end things really quickly or maybe something beautiful can come of it. I guess it went okay. We got married.
What did you sing to her?
Some early traditional stuff, some Bob Dylan stuff, some like early Jim James solo stuff before he did My Morning Jacket. And I was composing my own songs at that point, too.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with the pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank. And in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before.
The founder of McDonald's?
The founder of McDonald's. But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said, I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways, because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Eunice Count's plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameenbank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back, and he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen, and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him, or were you like, yeah, of course, it's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me, and I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman. And so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do at addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye, that I could do it. And of course, that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus, and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I've been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year? Things that surprised you?
Yeah.
Things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job, because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn a $40 or a $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is, around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize. But while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest. Huh. And he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So, like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period? Like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like 6 or 7 staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for 3-4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000 I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million by the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated, I was barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board. And we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's one guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal. And I got up my courage to ask him to help me, and he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more. Yeah. And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital, and it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So that planted a seed of, my God, we're onto something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Klein Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years, where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than 1 million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together, and it was so improbable. We weren't on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning, and yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and one of my board members really took up the leadership role. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these, you know, 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of a agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule, but they kind of scared him. And from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi. In Bangladesh, which was the name of the village, and yet when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women, and they began to socialize more and establish, you know, bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I'd lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically the same, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
If you look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers. And of the rest, it's anywhere between 50 and 90%. Microlending, and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages, is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate. And if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. the man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, they bring the other women, bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible. And I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.